We want to build a community and share other women's stories. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Tea with TE podcast. Today I've got the esteemed Janet Fowlty with me. Janet has just finished her term as the chair lady of Deloitte and is also a successful author of a book called Arrive and Thrive. Janet, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on.
I'm so delighted to be here, and I have to say I love the introduction as a chair lady. So we've been really working hard in the U.S. to move the conversation from chairman to chair, but I love chair lady, so we're just going to keep rolling with that.
I think given it's a female-empowered podcast, we can stick along those lines.
Perfect.
Exactly. And honestly, thank you so much. And part of the reason having you here is to obviously share those incredible stories that have got you to where you are today. I think what would be useful if we could learn a bit more about you, just as an opening comment, just to hear a bit about the journey that you've been on from a career perspective.
Excellent. Yes. And thank you again for having me. So a relatively long career at this point, so I'll try to do the very quick version. I graduated from university with no idea whatsoever what I wanted to do in the US. It can be a bit more amorphous, and I decided I would just try consulting as a way to, frankly, extend the need to make a decision about a career. And 30 plus years later, I found myself still as a consultant. So that's sort of how my career started. Sort of two big pieces. My first half of my professional life was spent serving clients at the intersection of Wall Street and technology. Okay. Doing work that today we'd much more glamorously call digital transformation. It wasn't nearly as glamorous then. And then the second half of my career leading a wide variety of businesses for Deloitte, from the technology business to the federal government business for something totally different than Wall Street, to being the CEO of Deloitte Consulting, to then having the incredible privilege to be the chair of Deloitte overall. So that's sort of my career outline in a nutshell. The thing that I would sort of pull through this conversation is I do think I had the opportunity to lead and the opportunity to help shape so many businesses because of my focus on people and talent. I mean, you can think of consulting as being very technical and you've got lots of expertise in your industry or your offering, but I do think it's a people-centric business at the end of the day, like so many businesses are. And I always had a high interest in how do you build great teams? How do you think about the culture of the organization? And that, I think, led to those opportunities. And then maybe the last background thing I'll talk about, which I think is important, even though you asked about career, is a little bit about family. Yeah. My husband and I got married right actually before I started my career at Deloitte. And so we've gone in lockstep. And we have twins who are in their mid-20s, who are the center of were for many years the center of my universe, and they would still claim they should be the center of my universe, even in their mid-20s. And our home base is in Chicago in the U.S. So that's just a little bit about me personally as well.
Amazing. And thank you for sharing. I think it's always nice to learn on the personal side too. As the first chair lady of, I'm using that term again, as the first woman, female CEO, as well as part of Deloitte Consulting, you must have seen a lot and been through a lot, particularly as a female. So I would love to understand, and I know that we will talk a lot about this, and you've Arrive and Thrive talks about this in particular for the female leaders that are coming through, but how do you believe that women can flourish in leadership roles despite thinking about gender disparity as an example?
Yeah, so it's interesting for me because starting my career, as I said, at the intersection of Wall Street and technology, there were no women whatsoever. And frankly, that wasn't something that fussed me much because it was sort of the environment I walked into right out of university, and I frankly didn't know much of an alternative. And so I think what you would probably expect me to do is I did my best to sort of fit in and conform and meet the norm. Obviously, there's lots of ways I could not meet the norm, but I did my best to sort of button up and try to sort of match the pedigree and the way with which the man I was working with carried myself. It's really over time that I came to understand and appreciate both the complexities of being a woman leader, everything from the complexities of being a young parent. I actually had a really critical presentation as I was going up to become a partner when I was 7 months pregnant with twins, which was, that is a sight that no one should have to behold, but was a, you know, a complex moment, to really understanding, frankly, though Deloitte has led around women for decades, and I actually was, as you pointed out, the first CEO of a large consulting business, not only in Deloitte, but actually writ large. And now there have been many. But also, there was a woman chair before me. So she broke a lot of ground, which was amazing. Her name is Sharon Allen. But what I came to understand and appreciate the complexity was around sponsorship. And the importance of having people who would absolutely walk over glass and use their political capital to help you. As I figured that out, and I was incredibly fortunate to have people who did that for me, I very quickly figured out what an important part of my leadership sort of philosophy that was, and my expectation of leaders on my own team, that I both was very invested in sponsoring, so putting my political capital on the line to help people who are not just like me, or not just like the norm, depending on how you think about it, and how important it was to have that be sort of the team's responsibility. So I'm sure we'll talk about authenticity in this discussion as well, because that's another thread I think we should pull through. But to me, I started very naive about the differences. And I feel I was probably better sort of lucky than good to that end. But over time, really understanding how important it was to make sure that you had politically aligned support, and people who were willing to put their political capital to help you was a huge differentiator for me over the course of my career.
And thank you so much for talking. And I know we will talk about the authenticity piece. I think just kind of sharing the fact that you were probably one of the first women, but actually for you, it didn't feel that much different. And I think sometimes it's easy enough to get swept up in the fact that you are the only female in the room. And I think saying, actually kind of just thinking about that, and that actually it's, if you are just used to what you're normal, like what you're working with, I think it's hopefully something that people can take away and just say, look, don't try not to think about it and separate the lines or keep the lines blurred.
But you also have to make sure if you're the first that you're not the last. Yes. So that's a little bit of my point around sponsorship. I mean, I felt such a responsibility being the first in many rooms that one of my roles was to make sure I was absolutely opening the doors for so many more behind me.
Yeah.
So yes, not obsessing about being the first or the only, but then figuring out how do you change the landscape?
Yeah. And how was it in your career, obviously having to then have twins and help to be a mother and go through that process in terms of being a mother, whilst obviously you're, as you say, you're kind of going on the partner track, which sounds like just crazy, crazy timing.
You know, I really think about it as one day at a time.
Okay.
And if I had, and it's funny, there are people who have grand life plans. I was not one of those. People who have them, fabulous. I'm so happy for you. I was a young manager, probably in my mid-20s, and I was sitting in this session, and a guy gets up and it was a leadership development session. And the guy gets up and he says, you know, the only people that are successful in life are the ones that have one day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, 5 year, and 10 year plans. And I was like, okay, well, it's been good so far, but I guess I'm done, because that was not me whatsoever. And for those people that have that kind of sort of roadmap laid out for them, you know, hooray, cheers to you. I think what you have to realize is that there's going to be so many twists and turns, that adaptability is such a critical skill and capability. For me, it was very much one day at a time. When I went out on leave to have my children, you know, I didn't know, was I going to come back to work at all? Was I going to come back part-time? Was I going to come back full-time? Was I going to come back and serve clients? Was I going to try to move to a role that was more back office focused, so I wouldn't have the intensity of client service? I didn't know. And for me, at each chapter of the intersection of my personal and professional life, it adapted and changed. I worked a part-time schedule. I did work in an internal back office role. I took some client assignments that were not the most interesting or compelling because it allowed me to travel less. So I did about every combination of things you could possibly imagine to figure out how to have the intersection of my personal and professional life work. And it changed with absolutely every chapter. So it's one thing to be the mom of young children. I was then actually diagnosed with breast cancer when my kids were
schooling.
And so that was a whole complicated moment for sure. And I talk about that very, I know I'm meandering off your question here, but I talk about that very publicly because my boss at the time, I just got in my first big national leadership role had to have been within a week of getting this diagnosis of breast cancer. And my boss at the time was trying to be helpful. And he said, you should keep this really low key and you shouldn't tell people. And he was trying to be helpful and supportive because he thought that illness would be viewed as a sign of weakness or that I couldn't do the role or I couldn't continue to advance. And so I followed his counsel. What I found over time when I got the courage to start to talk about it is it was so powerful because you can have this impression that everyone who moves to an executive level's life is nice and neat and tidy and perfect. And mine is far from that. So I navigated through all of that. And then when my daughter was in high school, she actually got quite ill. And so a lot of complexity. And I have an amazing husband who has been an incredible partner through navigating all of it, you know, life and work throw at us. But I felt really like I wanted to be the primary interface with her physicians. And that was incredibly important to me to be that person. And so as you can imagine, in each of those chapters, what my family needed and what my career needed were very different. So to me, it's about one day at a time, not trying to worry about the grand plan, one foot in front of the other, and knowing that life is going to throw you all sorts of curves that you could not possibly anticipate. And it's how you react and frankly, how your organization and your teams react that I found to be so important.
Wow. Sounds like you've had a lot to overcome. And another thing I think threw everybody off.
That is that everyone has a lot to overcome,
exactly.
Right? It's not all, you know, we don't always talk about it because sometimes it's uncomfortable to talk about it. But I think it's important to talk about it, to realize that, you know, no one has this nice, shiny, tidy, picture perfect life, and life throws you all sorts of curveballs, and it's how you respond and how your organization responds. And I've been the privilege to be in an organization that responded well. I think if I didn't, I would have taken a very different path.
Exactly. And that's also something that can be said for, I guess, the journey that you've been on with Deloitte, which is great. And I think another curveball that was thrown at everybody was the pandemic. And obviously during this time is when you and some other authors, I guess, and I'd love to hear you explain the journey to me in terms of how you got together and how this even came about. But that's when you wrote Arrive and Thrive. And it's obviously a fantastic book, which is focused on females. And I know that it's essentially looking at the leadership journey and the principles around that. But where did that concept come from and how did you get to Arrive and Thrive?
So maybe to back up, because I think it is important to talk about the pandemic for a hot second, is that I took my role as the chair of Deloitte in June of 2019. So it was just, and it had not been my plan to be the chair of Deloitte. The board had come and asked me to consider running for one of the elected leader roles. And so I was literally just sort of settling into the role and what it meant to operate in this role. And the pandemic hits. And so like everyone, had to sort of rethink so many dimensions of both how you lead and your personal life and et cetera. So a lot coming at us. Though I will tell you, I share that backstory because my co-author had even more coming at her. So Deloitte and Simmons University, which is a small women's college in the U.S., have a long-standing relationship focused on women's leadership. Simmons had a new woman president coming in 2019, and she happened to be Black. And there are not very many Black university presidents in the U.S. And so she's, you know, an amazing, amazing accomplished academic, and a really great set of lived experiences to lead a women's college and to talk about women's leadership. So our teams got together and said, you know, we think that Janet and Lynn should write a book on women's leadership. And I will tell you, both of us were like, really? Does the world really need another book on women's leadership? But our teams pushed us, as good teams do. And we came up with this space of not just how do you get there, not just how do you arrive, but once you're there, how do you thrive? And, you know, we were very complimented. She's an academic and spent her whole career in academia. I've obviously spent my career in the business community. We have a third amazing author who's a leadership coach, Susan McKenna Brady. And so the three of us come from very different perspectives. Well, I'm just settling into my role. The pandemic hits. We'd already decided to write this book. But Lynn coming in as a university president in a small university, her entire world was turned upside down.
Yeah, of course.
And I want to say she started right about the start of the pandemic. And I thought, okay, there's no way this woman's going to want to actually write this book. Like, she's stepping in as a university president. Universities were in turmoil and figuring out how to serve, you know, their students. And she was new into the conversation. But to her credit, you know, we had a call scheduled and I thought she was going to say, okay, yeah, let's pause this for a couple of years, if forever, but she was all in. And why we wrote it was essentially because we thought that the conversation deserved attention through the lens of storytelling, through the lens of data and research, because she's an academic, and through the lens of being very practical. So I'm a person who likes storytelling, as you can probably tell from this conversation, but also super practical. And so the book is filled with lists and tools and techniques and templates. And then the last thing I'll say is that we decided that it needed to be just more than our three voices. And so we opened up our proverbial Rolodex to the contact lists on our phone. And we decided to call some of the senior most people that we know and ask them if they wanted to contribute to the book and share their stories. And we were so, so grateful that I think we actually hit on something, that we got a great set of executives to also contribute their own stories, from the CEO of Pfizer, who was in the middle of, you know, who was in the middle of working on the ever important vaccines, to the head of a healthcare system in the U.S., to the CFO of Salesforce, a tech company that was going through big change, through a senior journalist. So we decided to pull all these voices in addition to our own to talk about what are the practices that you need to thrive as a leader, whether a young leader or a very tenured leader. So that's a little bit of the backstory of how the book came to be and why we thought it was important to write it.
Incredible. I only heard about this from you recently, so I'm making my way through it and I'm enjoying where I am so far, but I'm looking forward to hearing your takes from this today, and then I can obviously apply that when I'm listening even more. But so thinking about the book and the seven principles, and I know that two of them are thinking about your investing in your best self and fostering resilience. So looking at that, how can these practices help women to lead effectively?
Investing in your best self is interesting because I mentioned we co-authored the book, and I will tell you that that is not, and we each took lead on one of the chapters, actually on a few of the chapters and practices. And that is not one that I led on. As you can imagine, the woman that's a leadership coach focused on investing in your best self, because that's what she helps people do for a living.
Okay.
Here's what I would say, and you can maybe tell a little bit of this from my backstory. I've been always very good at prioritizing the things that were important to me. And that's something that, frankly, is, to your resilience point, was a survival technique. If I wasn't creating the time and the space for the things that were important to me, I would not have survived or thrived, frankly, in this environment. What I learned through the process of writing this book, actually, and learning from my co-authors, is that so many people, and women in particular, have this idea that if you take a moment to pause and be reflective, and really think about what matters to you, get to know yourself and focus on that. My impression was always that that was time wasted, and that sort of a moment in a pause, a moment not moving forward, was not a good use of time. And so I've come to appreciate somewhat through becoming older and somewhat from writing this book, is that investing in your best self and not just prioritizing fitness and family, but really knowing yourself, knowing your strengths, knowing what matters to you and being grounded in those principles is not time. And so what we tried to do is create a set of tools and techniques and exercises that even for people like me who are much more comfortable running a million miles an hour than sitting down and being reflective, what was time very well spent. Now, sort of just a funny side story, though, I was being interviewed right after the book came out on a national radio program here in the U.S., on Bloomberg Radio. And I got asked about meditation because my co-authors and I, you know, we had some editorial control over the entire book, but there are some things that were not entirely true to us. And Susan writes about her journey in meditation, and I get asked about meditation and on this in this national radio program, and I say, okay, I have to fully admit that I'm still a work in progress when it comes to meditating. I'm working on knowing myself and knowing myself well, and I do intellectually understand how important it is to know yourself and know your values.
Yeah.
But meditating was still very much a work in progress for me.
And how about now?
I have the Calm app downloaded on my phone.
Okay.
I would still say that I focused on knowing myself by doing lots of reading, a little bit of writing, but mostly I do it through reading to push myself versus meditating. What about you?
I have the Headspace app, so I try and do a couple of minutes, but I'm probably once per week, which is not very frequently.
Yeah, so you're the work in progress, like
in your, I'm in your camp, yes.
But I want to just pull on that thread just a little bit, because there's lots of different ways to invest in your best self and know yourself. And there's not, you know, one of the threads and themes of not only this book, but how I think about focusing on leadership is it's very personal.
Yeah.
And yes, there's a technique that might work beautifully for you that might not work at all for me. And there's no one size fits all here in terms of being a centered leader, which is really what this is all about.
Yeah.
And knowing who you are and knowing what matters to you. And for those people that, you know, that where meditation works for them or journaling works for them, that is amazing. For me, reading and reflecting is probably the thing that I've tried to spend more time on that's actually been quite helpful.
Yeah, interesting. I would say mine is probably reading also and walking. Walking is more like my meditation. It's that's when I get my own headspace.
Love
I like
that.
Yeah, put in an audible and go for a walk in
Perfect.
The morning.
I'm right there with you.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like that's just as decompressing than an app. Like you say, I think it's each to your own.
Exactly.
Thinking more broadly about the seven practices, Janet, and what's personal to you. And obviously you just mentioned there that you kind of had a chapter that you took ownership of. So I'm sure there is a principle that sticks out to you the most, but what is that?
So there's a couple. Let me start by talking about inspiring a bold vision.
Okay.
And why I want to talk about this is because I will tell you that I never thought that I would have the privilege to lead at the level that I've had the privilege to lead. And the reason that I thought that was because I'm not the type of person that wakes up at 4 a.m. with a brilliant new idea that no one's ever thought of.
Mm-hmm.
That was never me, that isn't me, and that will never be me. My brain does not work that way.
Yeah.
I think as a business society and culture, that we sort of hold that up as this ideal, that, you know, the Shazam moment of something no one's ever thought of. I thought, well, I'm not that person, so I'm not going to have the opportunity to lead. Because I think it's sort of well understood that you need to have, you know, both strategy and vision as things that you do well as a leader today. And what I came to appreciate over the years was that the things I was really good at actually made me a very visionary leader. And that was listening really well, that was looking for white space, that was for creating a team environment where people could really collaborate and really bring their best ideas to bear. I was really good at communicating a vision, socializing it, building momentum around it and enthusiasm around it. And so for me, this idea, and we chose the words very carefully about inspiring a bold vision versus creating one, is the creation is one thing, and visions can be created many ways. It can be an individual who wakes up at 4 a.m, but if you can't convince those around you to go on a journey with you and overcome all the obstacles and the hard things in your way, then that idea will die, you know, on the proverbial shelf.
Yeah.
But for those people that can create an environment where the vision gets built and then create the energy and followership to see it through, that's the real value. So that's one that I frankly hadn't thought about as a practice until I was thinking about writing this book. And as I reflected on my own journey, was super clear that that is something that is something that I want women to have confidence in.
Yeah.
That there's not just one way to be a visionary leader.
Yeah.
And so for me, that is something I've been talking a lot about, because I do think a lot of people, men and women in particular, can sometimes be intimidated by this idea of vision. And we really work to, as we thought about how to write about it, and I've thought a lot about the things that so many of us are good at, play absolutely into being a visionary leader.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because I think a lot of people automatically think they have to be one of these ideas people that can bring something new to the table every day, when actually, like you say, it doesn't have to be that at all. And I think you can come up with inspiration through different means.
Yeah.
So I think people will resonate with that. I certainly am not somebody that wakes up in the morning with this revolutionary idea.
I mean, I think so few people actually are.
Yeah.
And frankly, some of them that are don't actually have the ability to then build the followership and the ability to see it through. And so this idea that there's lots of different ways to be a visionary leader, and that actually some of the things that women are very good at can be superpowers to being a visionary leader.
And then when you say kind of actually seeing it through, can you speak to that a little bit more, in terms of, just so people can take that away and say, okay, I know how to put that into action. But how do you think people can take that so it actually can be adopted?
Well, I think some of it is how you come up with a vision or the strategy in the first place, which is doing that in a way that builds consensus and enthusiasm amongst your team. And so for me, you know, it depends on the size of your organization, the size of your team, but I think about concentric circles, and you obviously have the team or the circle that actually comes up with a vision or the idea and bringing them along the journey. But then how do you enroll others in your organization? I'm very deliberate about that in terms of, and I spend a lot of time thinking about how do you tailor the message and what's in it for them, in terms of how you think about building in enthusiasm and esprit de corps around, especially if it's a shift in direction for the organization.
Yeah.
And what it means for them and why it should excite them, both in terms of being a business person, but also in terms of being personal. You know, how you think about how does this shift in direction will help this person achieve the goals or the things that they're excited to do and their ambition. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's about, how do you build, you know, how do you manage your stakeholders, which can be a wide variety. You know, if it's a public company, you have the public and your board, you have your team itself, you have your clients, but thinking about those each as very distinct and different sets of stakeholders, and how do you tailor the message and refine the message for each of them. And maybe the last thing I'll say on that point, and I found this to be a really important part of my own leadership style, is how are you also adaptable when things don't go the way that you think they're going to go?
Yeah.
Knowing the vulnerability and adaptability doesn't mean that you're not incredibly enthusiastic and all in, but you also say, oh, you know, this is where we are now, but, you know, maybe you know, 1 week, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, there's new information. You've learned something, either an external force that's changed or something in your strategy that doesn't line up well. The humility to say, here's where we were, here's how we're shifting or refining, I think also builds a lot of trust and a lot of confidence, as opposed to, you know, here's the hill we're taking and we're going to do whatever we can to take that hill.
Yeah.
And we will sort of look, we'll be sort of in this tunnel to that end.
Yeah. That probably leads very well into the next topic, which is authenticity, which I know, again, you talk about in the book and the importance of that in terms of being able to thrive as a leader. What are your thoughts and any advice to share around kind of creating authenticity, which I do think links very well to what you were just saying?
So when I started my career, let's just say that authenticity was not a word that we used, a concept that was celebrated. And as I said earlier, you did everything you could to fit into the proverbial box that you were in as well as humanly possible.
Yeah.
What I found, and now you flash forward to today, you know, authenticity is a word and language that's used a lot. And I think that's amazing. I also think we have to be thoughtful about what does authenticity mean within the setting that you're in, because I think there is authenticity when you're home with your family and there's authenticity in a work environment. And those are two different things. But let me just talk a moment about my journey and when I realized how much it mattered. I was a young mom. And I had a really complex client situation that I was navigating that was really important to me, both personally and professionally, to get right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a very diverse team because I needed a lot of big brains and different brains in my own to get this work to done. And frankly, I was at a point where I could not pretend to be someone that I was not. And I was, you know, pretty tired from navigating newborn twins. I had this really complex client situation, and I started to show a little bit more of myself. Now, I didn't sort of let it all hang out, but I started to share some of what I was going through because, frankly, it was just too exhausting to do anything else. And I found this really magical thing happened, which was that when I started to show a little bit more of myself, my team members felt comfortable showing a little bit more of themselves. And we know today, because it's well studied, that when you are more comfortable and more confident in yourself, that you actually produce better work and better outcomes.
Yeah.
And so it was this very magical moment where I started to just this little chink in the proverbial armor.
Yeah.
And it was an incredible team, incredible outputs. Enormous numbers of partners at Deloitte today from that very project, from people who were, you know, just starting their careers to quite senior people. And I think a big piece of that was we together created an environment where people were more comfortable in their own skin and could talk about what was important to them, what was happening in their personal lives, what they needed to be successful. And so that was a real moment for me where I realized that not only did this make my life better because I didn't have to have such the shield or protective force up, but then it actually created a much stronger team and much better results. Now, the last thing I'll say on authenticity is I do hear this feedback a lot that it's very easy to be authentic when you're at the top. And yes, if you're sitting at the top of an organization, sort of being more clear about what matters to you and what might be different is something that is much easier. And so I think I would encourage, you know, the younger women or men and women who are listening to this conversation to sort of think about sort of testing with your colleagues, you know, so where the authenticity boundaries are. Okay. And I would encourage you to figure out sort of how far you can comfortably and confidently push being yourself, because you're just going to be a better performer. You're going to be a better teammate. People are going to want to follow you and be with you more, regardless of where you are in your career. And I still have things that I'm uncomfortable talking about.
Yeah, of course.
So I talked about health. You know, I certainly talked about raising my family, but I, to this day, have things that push me. And I'll just share. You know, for me, it's a current place where I'm grappling with authenticity is around golf.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're a golfer. Are you a golfer?
I'm not. I'm sorry.
Yes. No. And see, you just said it. You just said, I'm sorry. And people, so I am not a golfer.
Okay.
I am not interested in the game of golf. I'm totally intimidated by it.
Yeah.
I avoid it pretty much at all possible costs. One is because, you know, I grew up in a scientific family where golf was something that, like, people had no idea about. The second is I have zero hand-eye coordination, zero. I'm generally athletic and fit, but I have zero hand-eye coordination. So for me, I talk about my fear and anxiety of golf as my current way to sort of share my authenticity, because it is so stereotypical. Of course, she must play golf and she's tall and she has, you know, broader shoulders and, you know, of course she must be a great golfer. Oh no, I avoid golf at all possible costs. So that is my authentic moment with you today. That is still a work in progress for me to talk about. So thank you for letting me practice. I'm building my confidence and talking about that.
And thank you for sharing that and for having courage, which I think leads us quite nicely on to the next topic. So I know that is, I can personally say that I struggled with this in the first part of my career, was being able to have courage to either speak up or talk about things, or cultivating kind of my own personal courage in my authenticity, I guess. And I think that, again, kind of works well with what you've just been saying. So how can we get people to talk about their fear of golf, for example, and not wanting to play the game?
So I think these topics are all very intertwined, as you so well point out. I think if I stripped everything else away and I talked about why I had the privilege to lead as I have had the privilege to lead, I would say it is because I have focused on cultivating courage.
Okay.
And I want to start with sort of base definition, which is courage is very personal. Mm-hmm. And what might be courageous to me might not be courageous to you at all. Yeah. So courage is actually overcoming something that gives you fear and anxiety,
yeah,
versus something that is viewed as courageous writ large. I mean, there's certainly acts of courage in society that we can all look at, and pretty much we can all agree running into a burning building is an act of courage. But the little acts of courage that are the things that make you uncomfortable or you anxious, I actually think are the things that give you great strength as a leader. You know, for me, the thing that I've worked the hardest at over the years is having courageous conversations. And those are, for me, courage is having a conversation with someone on something that they don't want to hear and giving feedback they don't want to hear, giving advice they don't want to hear. You know, I grew up, as many certainly women in the culture I grew up in, or girls, that you want to be the pleaser. You want everyone to be happy. You're the person that makes sure that everyone is, you know, sort of good and calm and everyone gets along. Well, the courage to have hard conversations is the inverse of that, or it can be perceived as the inverse of that. So for me, something I've really worked on is cultivating the courage to have really hard conversations, whether that's giving feedback to a teammate, whether that is telling a client I don't think they're going in the right direction, which has, you know, not only personal courage, but also business risk.
Yeah.
And for me, how I built that is ridiculously simple technique, and it's going to sound very sort of mundane and boring, which is practice, practice, practice. So I will tell you, every time I have to have a conversation that I'm nervous to have because I have to steel my courage, I practice and I get input and I practice and I get input.
Yeah.
And so that's taken many forms over the years. Everything from the very first time I had to give someone some feedback that was really tough feedback to give. I happened to be sitting in a workspace with a colleague I really liked. And I said, listen, I have to give this feedback. Here's how I'm thinking about it. How do you think this will be received? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think that this person will hear this? Will this compel them to action? Yeah. To going in to deliver a very difficult message to the CEO of one of my clients, where I spent weeks preparing with a broad set of people to make sure that I was going to be incredibly clear on the feedback I was giving. So the first time I had to do the horrible task of actually letting somebody go from the organization, and my poor husband, because I practiced on him again and again and again, and he had nightmares about being fired from his job. But so for me, it is to do anything that is courageous, it is putting the work in.
Yeah.
And knowing that even for the most senior people, that practice and preparedness are how you, I believe, that's certainly how I have built courage and confidence. And I still, to this day, any conversation I have to have, by the way, conversation or something in writing.
Yeah.
And often, especially if I'm writing about something complex, we were talking about the pandemic earlier, mm-hmm. you know, we've had our fair share in the US and around the globe of very complex issues. If I have to write something, especially to a broad audience, but even to a yeah. small audience, I have lots of eyes review it and give me input and feedback. So doesn't mean that I'm still not taking a gulp before I walk into the conversation or before I hit send on my computer.
Yeah.
But if I know that I've gotten great input and great coaching, it helps yeah. me build my courage to do that.
Thank you. That's a real good way to think about it, I think. I think sometimes people, it's quite scary to eat the frog, but actually if you practice, it helps. Thinking more around, and we just have a couple of questions left, Janet, but thinking around influence and the power of that as a female leader, because I know that's a theme that comes through the book in every sense across all of the principles, really. Can you share any insights in terms of how you can help to influence when I think either you're not feeling your authentic self or you're not necessarily feel like you've got the courage to do so?
Some of that is preparedness that we were just talking
yeah.
about. Some of that is, so Ann Chow, who contributes to the book, who is the CEO of AT&T Business, the largest business mm-hmm. unit within AT&T, says, you know, she uses a trick, which is she thinks about the worst possible outcome that could happen and the mm-hmm. best possible outcome that could happen and being very deliberate. And usually the best possible outcome way outweighs the worst possible outcome. And so I love that framework of thinking about what's the worst possible thing that could happen and what's the best possible thing that can happen. And that helps sort of get yourself psyched up.
Yeah.
And then I've sort of hinted at this, but the term board of advisors sounds a little bit formal, but I almost always have a board of people who are helping coach me and challenge me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I transitioned out of my role as a chair, as I transitioned yeah. into my role as chair, as I've thought about the changes in my personal life, any hard thing I've had to go do, and it's not a static board, and it's not a board that's going to show up on any website, but it's a group of people that I trust,
yeah.
that I know will push me and challenge me to do the hard things.
Thank you. Amazing insights, I think, to be able to think about how you can build your own board of advisors, as you say. That's something that everybody can take away. Thinking about the future generation and those that I know are listening to this podcast and thinking, thank you so much, Janet, for sharing all of your insights. But what one piece of advice or what would you like the biggest thing someone to take away from reading Arrive and Thrive for their careers?
I would say the biggest thing is for women in particular to know that they are not in it alone and what they're feeling is not unique. There's so much more we could have talked about today, but hopefully you've gotten through this conversation that though I've had, the incredible opportunity to lead great businesses, that is not without its twists and turns and sets of experiences that each of you might be having, and know that there are so many other women and leaders cheering you on and here to help.
Yeah.
And it's the courage to ask for help. And that's, to me, knowing you're not in it alone is having the courage to ask for help.
Yes.
And know that there are so many people who are here to help you and want you to be wildly successful.
Thank you. That is the purpose of this community and why we are sharing these stories so that everybody can feel like they're not alone in it all. I do have one last question because it is the Tea with TE podcast. So how do you take your tea?
I'm being asked by a Brit. So it depends on what kind of tea. So I drink Earl Grey tea in the morning.
Okay.
The only other time I have to fight for that is when I'm traveling abroad with my colleagues from London, and there's not enough.
Yeah.
And I have it with a little bit of sugar. And then I have mint tea or green tea the rest of the day, plain, with nothing in it.
Amazing. And are you a coffee drinker too, or not really?
I'm not a coffee drinker.
Okay.
At all. So I drink my water and my teacup's gone because it is 9:30 in the morning already here. So, but that is how I drink my tea.
Well, thank you so much, Janet. Honestly, you've talked about so many different topics that I know everybody will find insightful. And I think there's so many things that people will take away from today. So really appreciate you sharing your story. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And much more importantly, thank you for creating a really important conversation that we're all privileged to be a part of.
Thank you. Appreciate that.